From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. With the choice of federal judge Sonia Sotomayor to fill Justice David Souter's vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court, President Obama seems to have found an unsinkable nominee. An inspiring personal biography, a long history of judicial even-handedness, presumed dependability on the litmus test issues nobody can actually speak aloud, and, not insignificantly, an Hispanic female twofer. But never mind Sotomayor's qualifications. In the weeks leading up to her confirmation hearings, she will be subjected to public evisceration. Tom Goldstein, a partner in the law firm Akin Gump and founder of SCOTUS Blog, says any high court nominee is but fuel for the politics industry.
No matter how principled, thoughtful, smart, and qualified the nominee, the other side will immediately paint them as an activist, outlier, outside the box, unprincipled person hell-bent on destroying the Constitution.
But there was a bonus this week because the likes of Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter and even former Speaker Newt Gingrich played the racism card. They suggested that Sotomayor is a reversed racist based on a remark she made some years back. Tell me about that.
In a speech that was converted into a law review article at Berkeley, she said that it's my hope that a Latina judge will make a more wise decision than a white male judge, something to that effect. And she's really talking about the simple fact that we are the sum of our experiences. And someone who has lived a different life from a upper middle class white male has been through more, has seen more, can add to the discussion. Anybody can have one sentence in their life kind of plucked out of context and made into a lot more. You could line that up with a half dozen cases where she's ruled against the discrimination claims of African Americans and Hispanics and realize that she's not deciding cases on the basis of her race.
This is exactly like the opposition research that occurs during political campaigns. Political operatives poring over reams of material looking for a gotcha.
It's in fact exactly like that because they want to put them up on television advertisements. And just to be clear, this is not a unique criticism of the ideologically engaged right. This was just as true when John Roberts was nominated and Sam Alito was nominated. And it's deeply unfortunate because it's, you know, not just wrong for the individual, but it undercuts the integrity of the federal judiciary.
Okay, now here's one difference between a Supreme Court nomination and a political campaign. In a political campaign, both camps get to go at each other, and the candidate is perpetually on the stump, putting his best foot forward. In the case of a judicial nominee, they more or less just sit there mute for 6 weeks throughout the process until they finally get to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee. How does that change the media dynamic?
It is terribly unfair to the nominees. Sonia Sotomayor, by tradition now, doesn't get to respond to those critics. Now, does that mean that the White House and she are totally powerless? No, not at all. They can find surrogates. They arrange calls. There was a call yesterday with the media with people who agree with their position, and they can get their views out there. But the public, when this is a claim about the individual, about the nominee, and it's something so jarring and serious that the person is a racist, the public in the sort of political campaign mode expects to hear from the individual, from her mouth, what she meant. And it's really not used to and not adapted to the weird context of a nomination that actually it's not going to be her. So those words from her are going to sit out there in that YouTube clip, and the public won't hear from her for another 6 weeks.
Yeah, there's one last wrinkle to this, and that is, barring the discovery of bodies dug up from underneath Sotomayor's porch, she's going to be confirmed by the Senate. She's a relatively uncontroversial nominee. Tell me again, what's the point of all this frenzy?
The point of it is fundraising. The point of it is for these organizations on the left and the right to justify their existence. We're not talking about the big questions about how expansively to read the Constitution or whether there's a right to privacy that involves an abortion right, those sorts of things. So there doesn't seem to be a good point.
If it's true, as you assert, that this process occurs largely to give a raison d'etre and a fundraising detra to polarizing political organizations. Should news organizations not keep that in mind before they rush to report the most extreme allegations and overheated rhetoric?
I think that they should. They shouldn't be dismissive when there are real issues about a nominee. Even if that's brought to your attention by an interest group, that's perfectly fine. But you have to just put on a filter of common sense that lets you know whether or not this is a serious charge in a very serious context, or is just somebody who has set their hair on fire in order to draw attention to themselves. And here, so far, it seems much more the latter than the former.
I just want you to know, Tom, that I don't really believe that fundraising detra is a word in any language.
No, sir. You're going to be on the radio saying that.
Tom, thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Tom Goldstein is founder and contributing editor of SCOTUS blog. Soon after, five men were arrested for breaking into the Democratic National Committee in Washington's Watergate office complex in the summer of 1972. New York Times reporter Robert M. Smith lunched with then FBI chief L. Patrick Gray. Smith was headed the next day to law school, but according to a new memoir by his Washington Bureau editor Robert Phelps, the soon-to-be ex-reporter returned to his editor one last time with an astonishing story. Gray had named names of Watergate conspirators and hinted that the cover-up reached as high as President Nixon himself. Whereupon, according to Phelps' own account, the hot lead died. For reasons Phelps cannot recall, he lost track of Smith's written and tape-recorded notes, and along with them, the scoop of the century. Ultimately, the Watergate scandal story was pieced together by the Washington Post's Woodward and Bernstein, who rightly claimed credit for toppling a president. Smith, meanwhile, went on to Yale Law School and a new career, keeping Gray's revelation secret for the past nearly 37 years. But Phelps' book brought Smith's story out of the shadows, and now the former reporter is here to shed more light. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, since your piece appeared, there has, of course, been a lot of discussion about it. And among those who have chimed in is the son of the former attorney general, who says that he doesn't believe that his father would have said to you what you said he said to you. What do you make of his skepticism?
No, I know. I actually talked to the gentleman for the first time just yesterday or the day before, and I was somewhat taken aback by his saying that. And frankly, I just said, look, you know, you're free to believe it or not. How do you think that I came by this concrete information if your father didn't give it to me? And he didn't know. But this feeds into my own ethical quandary. When L. Patrick Gray was alive, I felt under a complete obligation, journalistic duty indeed, to say nothing. And I said nothing. I didn't really think anything more of it until Bob Phelps contacted me and sent me a chapter from his book to confirm that it was all correct. I said, I can't help you. I was given this information on the basis that I would not disclose Mr. Graves having given it to me. And about a week went by, and I got an email back from Bob saying that once the source had died, the privilege was extinguished. Bob went ahead, published the book, and there was no further point in my not simply telling the story.
So never mind the past 37 years. I just want to go back to the immediate aftermath of the lunch you had with Patrick Gray. You get this information, which takes the Watergate cover-up clear to the Oval Office. You inform Bob Phelps. You leave the New York Times, and then sit and watch as nothing happens. The world spends 2 years watching the presidency go up in smoke. At no point did you call Phelps, in the first days after you left the paper to say, what the hell, Bob? I mean, I'm asking you that now. Bob, what the hell?
All right. It's certainly a fair question. You're a reporter. Please put yourself in my shoes. I briefed Bob Phelps on what Pat Gray had said during the lunch, He sat there in his office taking notes about it. He had in the room 36 first-rate reporters. It never crossed my mind that he did nothing with the information.
So this week, among those who have weighed in on the subject have been Bob Woodward, who reportedly, anyway, poo-pooed this whole development by saying that the story of Watergate was not about high-level tips, but about old-fashioned shoe-leather journalism, which incrementally led a path of corruption and illegality clear to the Oval Office. And I suppose he isn't wrong about that. On the other hand, how do you suppose the Times' failure to act on your tip changed the way the whole story evolved and might have changed history, certainly the history of journalism?
Whatever it would or wouldn't have done, I believe Bob Woodward is both right and wrong. When the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who is in charge, of course, of this inquiry, tells you these things at lunch, then I don't know whether things are entirely about extended peripatetic effort. This is not in any fashion to take anything away from Woodward and Bernstein, who did a tremendous job, I mean, to recite the obvious. But to say that these revelations weren't a monumental leap in information, I just can't see my way clear to agreeing with that.
Let me ask you one final question on a personal level. You've kept your own counsel on this for the last 37 years. You honored the reporter source privilege with L. Patrick Gray even after his death. But you must have shared this with somebody.
Nobody. I had a girlfriend, and she called and said, uh-huh, you know, you wouldn't even tell me about this.
Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Former New York Times reporter Robert M. Smith is a mediator based in San Francisco.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We've all heard of the toxic assets bound up in subprime mortgages that turned out to be worthless. Part of the reason why people and pension funds invested so heavily in them is because they earned top marks from credit rating agencies.
It can be a AAA. It can be down to a CCC. There are about 18 grades in the middle.
Attorney David Grace.
They look at a bond, which is a promise to pay money, and they decide how likely it is that the owner of the bond is going to get his or her money, and then they give the bond a grade. And when you decide to buy the bond, you look at the grade, and the better the grade, the better you feel.
The three biggest and best-known rating agencies are Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's, and now they're taking a lot of heat for highly rating worthless bonds. Last week, Rhode Island Democratic Senator Jack Reed introduced a bill that would, among other things, make it easier to sue the rating agencies for potentially billions of dollars. So how is this a media story? Well, the rating agencies say that their ratings are opinions, speech that should be protected under the First Amendment, like an editorial. David Grace, a securities lawyer who's argued against this defense, says that he can buy that argument. Sometimes. When an agency rates, say, a municipal bond, it can remain detached and impartial in its assessment. But, he says, rating agencies made most of their money in the arena of what's called structured finance. That's where investment banks sold bonds made up of subprime loans and other debt. Grace says he's spoken with former employees of rating agencies who say that the agencies felt pressure in those cases to help the banks restructure their bonds to earn the higher ratings. Not so for cities or companies when they call to complain about a rating.
The rating agencies can pretty much blow them off because no one client or customer of theirs amounts to a significant part of their revenue. So if a company calls up and says, we're really unhappy that you gave us a single A, we think we're a double A, Standard & Poor's or Fitch or Moody's can say, well, that's tough.
So what's different with the structured bonds?
All the business comes from a very small number of investment banks. And when somebody calls up and says, I accounted for 15% of your revenue in structured finance last year, then all of a sudden the rating agencies have to listen. I think there's no serious question that the investment banks were pressing the rating agencies to give bonds higher ratings than the rating agencies would otherwise have done.
And so now there are lawsuits pending against these ratings agencies. Can you sum up this First Amendment argument that the ratings agencies are making?
The rating agencies are saying that they're sort of like a restaurant critic. In their opinion, this bond is worth a triple A, just like a restaurant critic may say that that dinner was worth 3 stars. Restaurant critics are entitled to the protection of the First Amendment because they're journalists. So the rating agencies say that their three-letter ratings should be protected the same way as the 3-star rating from the restaurant critic.
And you believe that in some instances, this is a valid defense.
I do. In every case where the rating agency is not in the kitchen helping to prepare the meal, I think it's a reasonable defense. So, for example, when a municipality or a state or a corporation issues a bond, you won't find an analyst from the rating agency in the boardroom helping to structure the bond. But in the arena of structured finance, it's as though the rating agencies are in the kitchen helping to cook the meal. And then when the meal comes out, they sit down, eat the meal, and then write a rating of it or a review of the meal. That's when, in my opinion, they lose the protection of the First Amendment.
And in the case of these subprime-backed bonds, which has been so much at the heart of the financial collapse we've been experiencing, these ratings agencies have been in the kitchen with their chef's hats on. Why?
Because the investment banks that put these bonds together insisted that the rating agencies come into the kitchen. My own opinion is that if you're a player in the story, then you can write about it, but you don't have the First Amendment protection that a true journalist has.
I guess the other thing here to consider is that pension funds and many other companies are obligated by law to purchase only bonds that are rated. And usually they have to be AAA rated, right?
Yes. Pension funds, insurance companies, and banks are all required by their regulators to buy mostly AAA rated bonds. So that requirement guarantees that the rating agencies will have a huge market.
And yet, right there at the bottom of the rating that's published, there's a disclaimer that states that it's merely an opinion and ought not to be taken as a factual representation of the health of the company. So aren't they having it both ways? You have to buy my rating, but we are not obligated to be accurate?
Yes, it's very hard to sue them for negligence. It's very hard to prove the case against a rating agency, even if you get past the First Amendment.
According to a piece that you wrote, the general counsel of Fitch, a ratings agency, famously told the Senate committee investigating the collapse of Enron that the letter rating that his agency assigns a security is, quote, the world's shortest editorial, therefore protected by the First Amendment. Therefore, he should enjoy the same protections that a journalist enjoys. How did the committee buy that? And has it been tested in court?
It's just beginning to be tested in court. In one case in 2004, Fitch received a subpoena. It wasn't sued, but it was requested to produce its files about a bond that it rated. And it resisted the subpoena on the grounds that journalists don't have to comply with subpoenas in New York. For example, if someone's investigating public corruption and receives a subpoena for his interview notes, a journalist can invoke what we call the Shield Law, which protects journalists from the intrusion of a subpoena. Fitch tried to use the Shield Law to protect it, but the court said that it wasn't entitled to the Shield Law because it was actually involved in setting up the bond, not just in commenting about it. Therefore, it wasn't really a journalist. I think that's going to be the result in these cases on structured bonds because the rating agencies play such an important role, not only in giving opinions about them, but in structuring them in the first place.
David, thank you very much.
Well, it's my pleasure, Brooke. Thank you for having me.
David Grace is an attorney at Grace and Ellsworth in New York City. Attorney Floyd Abrams represented the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case. He's also argued First Amendment cases on behalf of almost every other major news outlet. Now he's defending the credit rating agency Standard & Poor's. Floyd, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Okay, so first of all, explain to me why this is more like an editorial. To me, it seems more like a clothing inspector. The people who leave the little number inside the clothing you buy, they leave their number so that if the zipper was put in backwards, for instance, they could theoretically take responsibility. Why are the ratings companies different from that?
Well, because the rating agencies use their models, use their heads, use their common sense, have ratings committees, they sit down and they come out with their best judgment as to what is likely to happen in the future about repayment of debt. And that is not subject to mathematical yes-no answers. It's not the same as saying my zipper is no good or the couch is no good. It's not being an inspector. It's not.
Fair enough. Let's move away from that analogy and let's go to one that attorney David Grace, who we just spoke to, came up with, that in many cases rating agencies want their ratings to be protected as opinion, like, say, a restaurant critics. But more often, he notes, they're like critics who go into the kitchen, make the food, and then come out and write about it. They help create these deals. And they have a financial stake in their own ratings because they're paid by the very companies they rate, a seemingly obvious conflict of interest.
Rating agencies have analytic standards. They apply those standards. And yes, they discuss with the entities that they're rating, why they're doing what they're doing. And if the entity asks them, well, you know, how come you're giving us a triple B instead of a double A? They tell them why. And if the entity wants to do things to get a higher rating, they can do them. And it is not inappropriate, in my view, so long as they take good steps to deal with the potential for conflict of interest. It is not inappropriate that they get paid by the entities they rate. I mean, it is not conceptually that distinguishable from, you know, a large entity which puts big ads in, what, a motorcycle magazine, and then they write about the motorcycles. Do they have to be careful? Yeah.
The fact of the matter here is that the ratings agencies in this case were so widely off the mark, ultimately, that it doesn't seem to have been just a series of mistakes of judgment. I mean, at least that's what outside people believe. You're saying that there was sufficient division between the raters and the ratees that they can't be charged with cooking their books for them.
Well, first of all, there's no cooking of books. And while some outsiders may have been prescient in predicting the future, the Federal Reserve Bank wasn't, the SEC wasn't, the President of the United States wasn't.
Because of these ratings, a lot of people charge.
It's not because of the ratings. It's because of the same events that occurred in this country, which affected the totality of American commercial life. The people that try to say, well, the rating agencies, they're responsible for this, I think are really looking for phantoms.
Last question. It's the big one. You're Floyd Abrams, legendary defender of the First Amendment, defender of the New York Times and the Pentagon Papers case and just about every other major news outlet. So you really believe that ratings agencies deserve the same First Amendment protection as journalists and the publishers of journalism?
I believe all sorts of entities deserve First Amendment rights, even though they're unpopular. Rating agencies express opinions, and as such, they should be as entitled to First Amendment protections as other people. And remember, there are some bad journalists out there. Bad. We protect them because we think it's a good thing for the country to protect them. And the First Amendment concludes, basically, it's a good thing to protect them, even if they do some pretty bad things. Here we're talking about writing about the future, trying to give a best assessment to the world about what's likely to happen in certain aspects of the marketplace. It's not a bad thing to do. It's not an ignoble thing. And yes, I think it ought to be protected.
Floyd, thank you very much.
Hey, it's very good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Floyd Abrams is a First Amendment scholar and a partner at the law firm Cahill, Gordon & Reindel.
Last month, in the midst of an Australian legal proceeding against the pharmaceutical company Merck, there was an interesting twist. The plaintiff introduced the Australasian Journal of Bone and Joint Medicine, published twice yearly from 2002 to 2005 by the largest medical journal publisher in the world, Elsevier. The journal touted Merck products like Vioxx, but it turns out the supposedly peer-reviewed journal was neither peer-reviewed nor an independent journal. It was completely created and paid for by Merck, an ad in journal clothing. In response, Elsevier has launched an internal review and has already found six more faux journals that claimed to be independent and peer-reviewed. We should note that it is common practice for legitimate peer-reviewed journals to take big money from Big Pharma for reprints of articles favorable to a particular drug, then to be circulated to doctors. But according to Peter Laurie, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Health Research Group, what Merck bought was far more than a reprint.
This is something that has the size of an actual medical journal article, the appearance of being peer-reviewed, but it's not.
So you get a call from a reporter from the journal The Scientist, and he introduced you to the Australasian Journal of Bone and Joint Medicine, and in fact sent you a couple of issues. What did you see?
On the face of it, it had many of the elements that might characterize a peer-reviewed journal. But when I looked closer at it, it started to be a little bit more suspicious. For one thing, it was volume 2, and sometimes that's a sign that there's something a little bit amiss if something is very, very new like this. For another, there were a number of unsigned editorials, which some journals do, but many others do not. And most strikingly, all of the articles in one way, shape, or form made the case for particular drugs made by Merck. And that's really what tipped me off.
Well, what a happy coincidence. An apparent journal bought and paid for by Merck that includes only positive appraisals of Merck drugs.
Yeah, what they did was slightly more subtle than that, in the sense that sometimes the name of the Merck drug, and there really were two of them, Fosamax and Vioxx, did not appear in the article, but the articles were about subjects that would be helpful to the drug. So there'd be an article that says, yes, screening for bone mineral density, which might lead to treatment for osteoporosis, is a good idea. And you don't necessarily have to make the connection directly to Fosamax, but a doctor might.
All right. So there's actually nothing shocking at all, unfortunately, that a pharma company would undertake this kind of deception. What is shocking is that Elsevier, which is among the most prominent medical journal publishers in the world, it publishes, among other titles, The Lancet, would participate in this petty fraud. Am I right to be so staggered by this?
Oh, I think you are. It's the involvement of the publisher in so conniving a fashion, in so deeply cynical a fashion, that I think is unusual in this case. And in addition, the initial refusal of the publisher to acknowledge that there was a problem and initially to refuse to investigate it makes it seem even worse. I mean, these are people who are, in principle, committed to notions of free speech and the exchange of ideas as being important. And yet when they come upon a very obviously irregular practice within their own ranks, they try to turn a blind eye to it, dismiss it by saying, this happened many years ago.
What this all comes down to, it seems to me, once again gets back to the fundamental structural conflict of interest that medical journal publishers face. Whether through advertising or through the reprint business, they get most of their revenue, or much of their revenue anyway, from pharma, the very institution whose research they're attempting to objectively review. Is there ultimately any way around that structural conflict?
Well, I suppose if government or more objective sources were in the business of providing information, running the journals or other sources that reviewed the journal articles when they came out in ways that were completely isolated from the conflicts of interest that invariably come with industry funding, things might be different. But there's no question that, especially for those journals that rely heavily on reprints, there is a conflict of interest. And it's undeniable that there would be the temptation to play down findings particularly disadvantageous to drug companies, those who might go on to buy your reprints, for example. And so that temptation will always be there. And until such time as we develop a system of providing more objective information to physicians, we're going to have to worry about the veracity of what is being consumed by the doctors.
All right. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Peter Lorre is Deputy Director of Public Citizens Health Research Group. We contacted Elsevier for comment, and the CEO of its health sciences division, Michael Hansen, responded with a statement asserting that he had only just learned that Elsevier's Australian office had, from 2000 to 2005, issued publications made to look like peer-reviewed journals for pharmaceutical clients. Quote, "This was an unacceptable practice, and we regret that it took place. We are currently conducting an internal review, but believe this was an isolated practice from a past period in time. It does not reflect the way we operate today. The individuals involved in the project have long since left the company. I have affirmed our business practices as they relate to what defines a journal and the proper use of disclosure language with our employees to ensure this does not happen again." Hansen concludes, "We have strict disclosure rules in place so that readers are aware of any financial interests behind a specific article or journal, or when entire compilation products are created for pharmaceutical marketing purposes."
Coming up, Death Rattle in Seattle, a close look at America's evolving media ecosystem.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Shh. On Thursday, former Chicago Tribune editor James Warren wrote on Atlantic.com about a secret gathering of the grand poobahs from the nation's biggest newspapers and newspaper chains in a drab Chicago suburb. They were there to ponder, quote, "models to monetize content." That is to say, how they could act collectively and legally, not so easy, to get Google or bloggers or anyone really to shell out for their content. The discussion must have had a sharp and sweaty existential edge, because now existence is the name of the newspaper game. And this week, instead of just reeling off some updates on dead or dying broadsheets, we thought we'd focus on a city. We could have just thrown a dart at the map, but we chose Seattle.
The final print edition ever of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer.
After 146 years, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer newspaper is folding.
Tomorrow will be the last print edition.
The end of an era, a symbol of change, as a growing number of readers get their news online.
Eli Sanders is a senior writer for Seattle's biggest alt-weekly, The Stranger, a paper that has a robust online presence. Many of the Seattle readers we talked to said that The Stranger's online blog, The Slog, is now their source for some of the City Hall reporting they used to get from the print version of the Post-Intelligencer, which folded in March. Sanders doesn't seem to glory in The Stranger's incursion on the PI's turf, because now the PI exists only in a stripped-down web-only form, and it's struggling to make a difference.
They're trying to make a go of a viable online-only newspaper with a staff of 20, and about 14 of those people being what they're calling news gatherers. Not reporters anymore, or editors, but news gatherers. They have had some scoops in the last month and a half. They broke a story about the Seattle Sounders and one of the players who had allegations of sexual assault against him. Those allegations were later shuffled aside. The prosecutors involved didn't follow up at all, and so the story ended up going nowhere. But the Sounders are a new team in Seattle, and there's a lot of interest in them, so there was a lot of interest in the PI's story.
In general, how are the news gatherers doing at gathering the news that the reporters used to report?
You can see them struggling to keep their heads above water, I think. If you go to the site today, you'll see a lot of links to other news outlets in the region for basic stories, links to the Seattle Times, which is the PI's former arch rival, which it would never have in the past wanted to credit on basic news of the city, links to the Tacoma News Tribune, which is a paper in the city south of Seattle. So they are trying valiantly with a staff of 14 news gatherers to cover the city in the way that their staff of 150 plus used to, but it's an impossible task.
Now, I know your own weekly, The Stranger, has filled some of that vacuum. How else has it been filled?
It's been filled by community blogs in some measure. West Seattle has West Seattle Blog. Ballard, which is a trendy neighborhood, has My Ballard. Capitol Hill has a number of blogs, including CapitolHillSeattle.com. Notable neighborhood blogs tend to be the wealthier ones. But in the poorer neighborhoods, you don't have blogs that are as well known. They exist, and they certainly cover the poorer neighborhoods, but they are not as robust as the others.
I want to ask you one last thing. The Seattle Times, now that it is the only printed daily in town, has it stepped up to the plate? Has its coverage improved?
One interesting thing about the Seattle Times posture since the closure of the PI is how gentle they've been with the PI readers. They've really bent over backwards not to dance on the grave of what was a 146-year-old Seattle institution. And to compete with the PI's new online posture as an aggregator, they've started aggregating. So the Times, in a way, presents a more humble face than it used to. To answer the question of whether they have upped their game, essentially, I think it's been difficult for them. They are going through layoffs, and they have a much reduced staff over their staff levels 2 years ago, which is also difficult and demoralizing. But they are doing a better job than the online-only PI at covering the city and the region for now, simply because they have more resources. Although that hasn't stopped them from being forced in moments over the last month and a half to link to the PI when it's broken stories, which gives the PI a feather in its online cap.
Eli, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Eli Sanders is a senior staff writer at Seattle's Alt Weekly, The Stranger.
Maybe the most prominent of the neighborhood blogs Sanders mentioned is the West Seattle blog, run by Tracy Record and her husband Patrick Sand. Actually, they bristle at the term blog. They prefer to call it a, quote, commercial news site operating in a blog format. And it's true, their blog, does a staggering amount of original nuts and bolts reporting on issues like real estate development, local schools, and crime. It was started in 2005 by the couple, but it was launched by an act of God.
It was 1 year after we started the site in December of 2006. The whole area here was hit by a tremendous windstorm, and our neighborhood in particular suffered from outages. And it was very difficult, particularly in the citywide media, to find any West Seattle-specific information. Some of the small readership we'd built up at the time started asking, do you guys know anything about what's going on? Can you find out any information? And so taking the skills that I had from more than a quarter century in journalism, we just kind of turned ourselves into a mobile news team and headed out.
And the readership really took off?
Once the windstorm kicked things off, we started noticing more and more that just wasn't getting covered or written about, and people would say, what do you know about this? What do you know about that? Particularly development projects and other things like that. So the more that we covered, the more people showed up to read about it.
During the Senate Future of Journalism hearings, David Simon, the creator of The Wire, argued that non-traditional journalism can't fill the vacuum left by the collapsing papers. And he said,
the day I run into a Huffington Post reporter at a Baltimore zoning board hearing is the day that I will be confident that we've actually reached some sort of equilibrium.
Well, obviously, what you do is different from the Huffington Post, but could you respond to that?
Absolutely. The growing neighborhood news movement, whether the people at the helm of sites are people like me with traditional journalism experience or people who are kind of learning on the job, are covering design review board meetings, school board meetings, community council meetings. They're writing about them. They're kicking off the discussion about them. They're creating places for communities to discuss them. And in many cases, some of the events and meetings that we cover every week are places where there are no other journalists. So it does kind of chap my hide sometimes to have it said that, well, if the newspapers go away, who's going to cover these meetings because they weren't covering them before?
You know, it's been a long complaint of traditional journalism that poor neighborhoods, working class people are undercovered. Do you worry that not having as big a revenue base to draw advertising money from those neighborhoods and fewer people with home internet access to log on to your site, fewer middle class folks with liberal arts degrees and free time to blog, will they be even less well covered if guys like you end up filling the gap of local news?
The one thing that people have to decide that they want to do when they set out to do this, and it's something that we did decide to do, is to cover all of the neighborhoods and all of the areas within your scope. For example, our peninsula has a little bit of a divide, almost a racial and a class divide, kind of literally east-west. And we set out to say, we're covering the entire peninsula. We're covering it as all of West Seattle. I'm not saying that we're doing a fabulous job of it. We have a lot of ways to go and a lot of people to reach out to. But there is, at least in Seattle, there are some factors that make the digital divide a little bit less glaring. The public libraries all offer internet access, for example, and schools do. Often we hear that children access information at schools and go home and tell their parents about it if they don't have internet access at home, and that's at least a start.
So what do you think? Do you think that neighborhood news sites like yours could ultimately supplant the metro dailies if they go down, or can they just really supplement them?
I think that it's a totally different world than what existed before. And what's happening is that sites like ours are giving people information that they previously didn't have access to. But I think that what there remains a need for, and some of this is being experimented on around here, is people with more of a citywide focus who perhaps contract out help. Some of the investigative and other types of reporters who've lost their jobs at organizations like the Paper PI saying, well, we'll go out and we'll be your guns for hire. We'll do investigative work, or we'll do investigative work of a broader scope, and perhaps you, the neighborhood sites, can link to us. We're really creating a new news ecosystem rather than talking about a one-for-one replacement.
Tracy, thank you very much.
Thanks for talking with me.
Tracy Record is the editor and co-publisher of the West Seattle blog. Of course, the Seattle PI's new website, owned by Hearst, is also vying for a place in that ecosystem. Many of the staffers that the online PI retained are actually columnists, but it held on to a few reporters, among them Scott Gutierrez. He says it's harder to report now, but they still do it.
I don't think there's necessarily any story that we can't do, but you're not going to get 3 days or a week or a month to sit down with a CD of emails or expense reports or a box full of records and be allowed to sift through and find your story. I think that kind of enterprise work has to be done incrementally here now.
Just before the paper version closed, you did a story about the police beating a 15-year-old girl.
Correct.
You got the documents, you logged the time to report it, you had the clout to get a response from the police department. Do you think that there's any way that the online PI could have pulled that off?
Yeah, in fact, I could point to another story I did just about 3 weeks after the print edition closed down. A Seattle police officer who had committed several instances of misconduct over his career, he'd been accused of slamming a teenage suspect's head into the back of the car during an arrest, and he was fired by the police chief, but then the department was ordered by a civil service commission to take him back. That's a story that we did that no one else reported on for whatever reason, and we also explained the issues of how this cop with a history of serious discipline and just overall incompetence was still allowed to keep his job and also get a pretty hefty financial package from the city for all the time that he was forced to take off from his job. It's a matter of knowing the right people at the right time and having people that are still willing to call you with a good tip.
How big is your staff now compared to what it was?
We were about, 150, 160 editorial staff, and now about 20 of us who are reporters and producers, and I think we have one photographer now.
Fundamentally, what you have is a shoestring operation.
Yeah, I mean, we are. We are a much leaner operation, and we're learning to adjust. And there's no doubt that there's some longer-term stories that we can't do as easily as we could have before. But I think in terms of just keeping people informed, in terms of reporting on what's happening, I still think that we're performing that service. And I feel that way just based on feedback I get from emails, from readers, what I hear from sources, who just say, even if you're a shell of your former self, we're still happy to have you around.
Scott, thanks very much.
Sure.
Scott Gutierrez is a reporter for SeattlePI.com. With the PI online, Seattle's sole daily is the Seattle Times. Once, the two papers were bound by a joint operating agreement, forced marriages in which rival papers share some costs, printing, delivery, and advertising, but still compete with separate newsrooms. When the joint operating agreement between the Times and the PI was signed in 1983, it seemed to make sense. But eventually, the PI began to shed subscribers, and by the time the paper died, its circulation was about half of what it was when the two papers first got hitched. David Boardman, the executive editor of the Seattle Times, says his city will always have at least one paper.
We're just confident that our newspaper and most newspapers will survive, particularly since the closure of the PI. We've seen tremendous public support and understanding of the value of what newspaper journalism is about. Now, ultimately, I'm not hung up on whether that gets delivered on a flexible plastic screen or ink on paper over time, but the essence of what we do, newspaper journalism, I'm absolutely confident there is a successful business model for that going forward, and there's certainly demand for it.
We were trying to understand what was happening to newspapers, and so we looked at Seattle, but we could have gone to Denver, where the Rocky Mountain News folded. We could have gone to Tucson, where the Citizen folded. Are we then not living through the slow death of print newspapers? Are we just watching the end of two newspaper towns?
Absolutely. We're watching the end of two newspaper towns, with a few possible exceptions in the very largest cities. But medium-sized cities like this one, there's just no way they can continue to support two newspapers. Will they continue to support one newspaper with a variety of other news and information sources springing up around that? Absolutely. And I think that's what we're seeing here is I think even the people who are running blogs and alternative newspapers and television, they recognize, as we do, that as the largest news gathering force, we're the center and will remain the center of the news and information ecosystem. But lots of new organisms will spring up, and I think that's a healthy thing.
So what you're saying, the citizens of Seattle and any other big American city ought to just stop worrying and learn to love the Internet.
Well, what they first ought to do is until we do find some answers to the business model questions, they ought to continue to subscribe to their newspaper because we need the subscriptions in order to continue to transition to other models. If they simply only get their newspaper news from the Internet, at this point, they're not making enough of a contribution. And if they want to think about it almost in an NPR model way, if they really want to support the news gathering machine that newspapers represent, they have to contribute.
David, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
David Boardman is the executive editor of the Seattle Times.
The future of newspapers is obviously anybody's guess, but not for want of thinking about it.
Imagine, if you will, sitting down to your morning coffee, turning on your home computer to read the day's newspaper. Well, it's not as far-fetched as it may seem. In fact,
it's a YouTube clip that has been streamed by more than a half million people. A 1981 news feature on San Francisco's local TV channel, KRON.
17 stories up in his fashionable North Beach apartment, Richard Halloran is calling a local number that will connect him with a computer in Columbus, Ohio.
The piece, by reporter Steve Newman, took a bemused look at a San Francisco Examiner experiment in delivering the day's paper on their newfangled home computer machines. All you do is dial your dial telephone, stuff the receiver into the rubber-gasketed phone coupler, endure a series of screechy modem tones, and 2 hours later, voila, all the day's text appears on your TV in a display with all the color and pizzazz of an ATM screen. It's so quaint and primitive. How stupid and oddly clothed all those people from the past were. Oh, and also eerily prescient about the issues that would define the newspaper industry 3 decades later. Here was an Examiner editor named David Cole.
This is an experiment. We're trying to figure out what it's going to mean to us as editors and reporters and what it means to the home user. And we're not in it to make money. We're not going to lose a lot, but we aren't going to make much either.
Pretty much nails it. The only details he failed to foresee were Craigslist, and the collapse of the entire business model. On the technology side, though, even the TV guy connected the dot matrix dots.
This is only the first step in newspapers by computer. Engineers now predict the day will come when we get all our newspapers and magazines by home computer, but that's a few years off. So for the moment,
yep,
at least...
Online magazines. It happened. That and just a touch of apocalypse.
Well, it takes over 2 hours to receive the entire text of the newspaper over the phone, and with an hourly use charge of $5, the new telepaper won't be much competition for the 20-cent street edition.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Cara Gianfrido and Ethan Cheel, and edited by Brooke. We had a technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.